Cat and Roots Revolution plus DJ Margo Hartenfeld. There will also be food and other refreshments. Again, that's Tanya Stevens in concert on Saturday, March 31st from 9 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. at the Tao Event Center, 631 Northeast Grand Avenue in Portland. This is an 18 and over show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
As the life is much too quick for your hurry, and there's too many problems, so tell me, oh, why worry?
Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting this great station, and you can apply today to join our board of directors to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to great use. The role played by our KBOO board of directors is essential. It's a great way to become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is April 16, 2018. We need folks who love KBOO and are committed to our community values. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock, and this is KBOO Portland. Time right now for Rising Up with Sonali.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Well over a million people protested against gun violence last Saturday in 800 marches around the country and world. The March for Our Lives events were spearheaded by student survivors of the Parkland shooting here in Southern California, where our program is based. Our correspondent, Nick Cha Kim, attended the satellite march in downtown Los Angeles, and today we'll play his special report, part of our Rising Up in the Streets series. Then we'll air speeches from the Washington, D.C. march by two young women of color, 11-year-old Naomi Wadler and 17-year-old Edna Chavez. Finally, investigative journalist Bernice Jung joins us to discuss her new book about sexual assault of low-wage women workers, women often left out of the hashtag MeToo conversations. Her book is called In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. That's coming up in just a moment. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Well over a million people marched in more than 800 protests against gun violence in every state in the U.S. and dozens of countries outside the U.S. on Saturday, March 24th. The March for Our Lives protests were spearheaded by student survivors of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting that happened on Valentine's Day in Parkland, Florida. The youth led a main march in Washington, D.C., where an estimated 800,000 people gathered to challenge the stranglehold that gun manufacturers have over politicians through their lobby group, the NRA. That figure eclipsed the Women's March in January 2017. Here in Southern California, where our program is based, tens of thousands marched in downtown Los Angeles. Our field correspondent, Nick Cha Kim, was there. And as part of our series, Rising Up in the Streets, we present this special report today.
Hi, I'm Nick Cha Kim. I'm here with Rising Up with Sonali. We're here at the March for Our Lives. Now, this protest was started by students, so let's see what they can do.
Welcome to March for Our Lives, Los Angeles. We are starting our march on 5th and Broadway here, and then we will be marching at least 5-6 blocks all the way to Grand Park, City Hall. I've dealt with a shooting before, not at my school, but it's very close to home for me. We're tired of adults really not caring about us. We're tired of them killing us. We want to do something about it. We want to clean up their mess.
We took a stand today, March 24th, 2018. We made it in 5 weeks. We did this. We did this.
To make sure that he doesn't have to deal with this when he grows up.
I'd like to see a future for my son where he doesn't have to be at a rally like this to worry about guns and his life and to worry about his, you know, whether he might be shot and killed at any day. But he should just worry about SATs. Should worry about STDs maybe. Worry about getting someone pregnant. Like those kind of worries, I'd rather him worry about than having to worry about his own life. I'm not a fan of assault rifles. I don't understand the reason for them in society. Look, I'm not saying to take away guns, but I'm saying that there should be some checks. When you have to drive a car, you have to take a test and get a license, right? For a gun, you can just go buy it. You don't even have to have that.
I'm here because I don't want to be next. I'm a student. I'm scared to go to school and be the next victim of a mass shooting. I'm scared, and I'm here to see change. I want lawmakers to put bills into action. I want lawmakers to stop the selling of bump stocks that turn weapons into semi-automatic weapons. I want lawmakers to stop the loophole system that's letting these people get the guns that are killing people, that are making them murderers. I want to see change. Go, hey, hey!
I am afraid to go to school.
Why is that? Is it the news? Is it just like the stuff that you're seeing on TV?
It's because of the stuff that I'm seeing and like how much gun shootings have been happening.
They are making us do shooter drills. We go behind the wall and we're squished and like, and we have to not take, we can't say anything. And then when the shooter knocks on our door or like pounds on our door, they go to the next door and then they'll think there's no kids here. That's what we do.
What do we want? Gun control. When do we want it? Now. What do we want? Gun control. When do we want it? Now. What do we want? Gun control. When do we want it? Now. What do we want? Gun control. When do we want it? Now.
No more guns. No more guns. No more guns. No more guns. No more guns.
So tell me, Bianca, why are you here?
Because I don't want no more guns, because guns are bad for people. If you don't come to events like this, it will probably not stop.
Now, tell me, Bianca, what grade are you in?
Second.
We're here to raise awareness.
To support all the families who have lost a child.
Yeah.
And to protect our schools, and to protect our families, and to protect our rights.
We participated in active shooter drills to prepare us if there's a shooting at our school.
What happens? I've never done that. Like, what happens at an
episode? Well, basically, there's like an alarm that goes off, and then they all kind of, you just find a classroom that to go into and just
turn off all the lights, lock the door,
put,
close the blinds,
put chairs up against the doors,
and hide.
And yeah, be away from, like, try to make yourself as little, like, as less visible as possible. So if there was an active shooter, you couldn't be seen.
Move away from the door.
Yeah.
Now, do you feel scared during the drill?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's so crazy. Like, it could happen to anyone. It could happen to my best friend's school. It could happen to my cousin's school in Maine.
Never
it could
know.
Happen to anyone. And the fact that we're still having to come out here and there's nothing being changed is ridiculous.
That we need to have stricter gun control, like, for example, background checks on the people who purchase guns.
Yeah.
And more security when it comes to schools and making sure that the students are safe and not just giving the teachers guns opposed to teaching everyone what to do in a situation like that.
I think that teachers getting guns is not the best solution, because adding more guns to the situation is just gonna cause more violence. We need to take away the guns and not add more.
Apathy is no longer an option. Your elected officials work for you. Do not
show
let
me
those
what democracy
who
looks
to accept
like.
Money.
Show me what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
Show me what community looks like.
What school are you guys from?
I want to support artists, women, children, Latino people, and I want the end to gun violence.
We have to make our voices heard and take action and let them know that we're here for a reason and we want to end the violence.
Yeah. I want to see more
people,
more diversity in the government. I want to see more people of color, more women, more younger people in the Congress.
Yeah, out with Trump.
Out with him.
Ban assault weapons. Ban all weapons. Give the power to the young people. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Give the power.
Give power to those that actually listen to the people of the country.
Yeah.
I mean, we shouldn't have to have this march to begin with.
These shootings have been happening for forever in the States, and nothing gets done. It's just thoughts and prayers. Nothing's happened. The same thing is happening. Thoughts and prayers is out. NRA needs to go down. They're filling these politicians' pockets with money. So that's why the politicians won't say anything, but we can't have that.
I am a teacher. I'm a community college instructor. And at our campus, we recently had an active shooter drill.
Children tell our story.
And we do so on a regular basis.
Story of tonight.
It's something that, alarmingly and unfortunately, it's a normalcy. I'm always talking to my students about safety on campus and to keep a watch and to be vigilant at all times. These drills are important, but at the same time, we do need to advocate for gun reform, because these drills are necessary, but we need to change the law.
Not too long ago, a kid actually got arrested at my school for making a threat to the school. And so I just think that all this needs to, like, stop, like, now.
Since I came here and I attended school, I've done active shooter drills. And yeah, still, this is really scary to just, like, think about hiding in the school and being really quiet if there is a shooter. This is really scary. As a student, I'm really proud that all of the students are being involved in this movement. I think it's really inspiring that kids are speaking up.
Telling the story of tonight.
The morning is
great. It makes me feel really good that the kids are the ones who actually started this, because it shows that it's not just adults who want change, that the kids want it too.
Even when the dark comes crashing through, when you need a friend to carry you, when you're broken on the ground.
The students are speaking for themselves. They deserve to be safe in schools. And I think it is definitely a marking point in our history of this country, of movements, of change, and of the future.
And I think that these students, the younger generation, my students, my student generation, they are going to do this, and I'm going to be standing along with them.
The story of tonight.
You guys are awesome.
That's a special report from the Los Angeles March for Our Lives this past Saturday by our field correspondent Nick Cha Kim. That's part of our series Rising Up in the Streets. If you're listening on the radio, you can watch the video version of this report on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can also find out more about our show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As part of our ongoing coverage of the March for Our Lives, we'll feature now the voices of two young women of color who were invited speakers to the main march in Washington, D.C. The Parkland students who spearheaded the movement for gun control have shown themselves to be serious about intersectional politics. They've credited the Black Lives Matter movement for inspiration, as well as linked school shootings to gun violence in inner cities. One of the speakers at the DC March for Our Lives was 11-year-old Naomi Wadler.
My name is Naomi, and I'm 11 years old. Me and my friend Carter led a walkout at our elementary school on the 14th. We walked out for 18 minutes, adding a minute to honor Cortland Arrington, an African-American girl who was the victim of gun violence in her school in Alabama after the Parkland shooting. I am here today to represent Cortland Arrington. I am here today to represent Hadiya Pendleton. I am here today to represent Tiana Thompson, who at just 16 was shot dead in her home here in Washington, D.C. I am here today to acknowledge and represent the African American girls whose stories don't make the front page of every national newspaper. Whose stories don't lead on the evening news. I represent the African-American women who are victims of gun violence, who are simply statistics instead of vibrant, beautiful girls at full of potential. It is my privilege to be here today. I am indeed full of privilege. My voice has been heard. I am here to acknowledge their stories, to say they matter, to say their names, because I can, and I was asked to be. For far too long, these names, these black girls and women, have been just numbers. I'm here to say never again for those girls too. I am here to say that everyone should value those girls too. People have said that I am too young to have these thoughts on my own. People have said that I am a tool of some nameless adult. It's not true. My friends and I might still be 11, and we might still be in elementary school, but we know. We know life isn't equal for everyone, and we know what is right and wrong. We also know that we stand in the shadow of the Capitol, and we know that we have 7 short years until we too have the right to vote. So I am here today to honor the words of Toni Morrison. If there is a book that you want to read, but it hasn't been written yet, you must be the one to write it. I urge everyone here and everyone who hears my voice to join me in telling the stories that aren't told. To honor the girls, the women of color who were murdered at disproportionate rates in this nation. I urge each of you to help me write the narrative for this world and understand so that these girls and women are never forgotten. Thank you.
That was Naomi Wadler, an 11-year-old student who spoke on Saturday at the Washington, D.C. March for Our Lives. Next, we'll turn to Edna Chavez, a 17-year-old student activist from South Central Los Angeles who also spoke.
My name is Edna Lisbeth Chavez, and I am from South Los Angeles, California, El Sur de Los Angeles. I am a 17-year-old senior at Manual Arts High School and a member of an organization called Community Coalition, where I am a youth leader at South Central Youth Empowered Through Action. At Community Coalition, we organize high school students to develop their leadership skills in order to push for educational justice in our communities. That's why I got involved. I wanted to impact policies and make sure our voices are heard. I am a youth leader. I am a survivor. I have lived in South LA my entire life and have lost many loved ones to gun violence. This is normal. Normal to the point that I've learned to duck from bullets before I learned how to read. My brother, he was in high school when he passed away. It was a day like any other day. Sunset going down on South Central. You hear pops thinking they're fireworks. They weren't pops. You see the melanin on your brother's skin turn gray. Ricardo was his name. Can y'all say it with me? Hero. I also lost my mother, my sister, and myself to that trauma and that anxiety. If the bullet did not kill me, that anxiety and that trauma will. I carry that trauma everywhere I go. I carry it with me in schools, in class, walking home, and visiting loved ones. And I am not alone in this experience. For decades, my community of South Los Angeles has become accustomed to this violence. It is normal to see candles. It is normal to see posters. It is normal to see balloons. It is normal to see flowers honoring the lives of black and brown youth that have lost their lives to a bullet. How can we cope with it when our school district has its own police department? Instead of making black and brown students feel safe, they continue to profile and criminalize us. Instead, we should have a department specializing in restorative justice. We need to tackle the root causes of the issues we face and come to an understanding on how to resolve them. I am here to honor the Florida students that lost their lives and to stand with the Parkland students. I am here today to honor Ricardo. I am here today to honor Stephen Clark. I am here today to uplift my South LA community. Enough is enough. Question. How many more Trojans have to die so that this problem is finally acknowledged? Policymakers, listen up. Army teachers will not work. More security in our schools does not work. Zero tolerance policies do not work. They make us feel like criminals. We should feel empowered and supported in our schools. Instead of funding these policies, fund mentorship programs, mental health resources, paid internship and job opportunities. My brother, like many others, would have benefited from this. So let's make it happen. It's important to work with people that are impacted by these issues, the people you represent. We need to focus on changing the conditions that foster violence and trauma. And that's how we will transform our communities and uplift our voices.
Edna Chavez is a 17-year-old student from South Central Los Angeles who spoke at the March for Our Lives protest on Saturday in Washington, D.C., one of several young women of color who were speaking. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Long before the hashtag MeToo movement exploded into international consciousness last summer and the revelations of Harvey Weinstein's abuses of Hollywood actresses became common knowledge, low-wage women were struggling with the same issues. Women workers in a variety of industries, from farming to janitorial work, domestic and hotel work, and more, have long been sexually victimized by those in power. Their fight for safety in the workplace has not often been the subject of media coverage. But some years ago, an investigative journalist began a series of reports on rape and sexual violence against women farm workers and janitors. Her work has now culminated in a well-timed book. My guest is Bernice Jung. She is an award-winning journalist for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She was a 2015-2016 Knight Wallace Fellow at the University of Michigan, and her book is called In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. Welcome to the program, Bernice.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So it is certainly a well-timed book, obviously, the culmination of years of work before hashtag MeToo became so well-known. And so it's really an important story for us to add to these issues of how women experience sexual violence in the workplace. Tell us how the story started. I mentioned that you did these investigative reports. Start with the women farm workers whose reporting was called, the reporting on their what they faced was called Rape in the Fields.
That's right. We've been working since 2012, actually, on this issue. I've been teaming up with some reporters at UC Berkeley and the local public radio station here, KQED, along with Univision and Frontline, to produce these multi-platform projects that have, you know, taken us across the country to look at not only farm workers, but night shift janitors and how this issue plays out. You know, in so many industries where we encounter low-wage workers and who come from immigrant backgrounds. And it really all started with a graduate student, actually, at UC Berkeley, who went out on a journalism internship and was looking at child labor in the fields, and in the process came across a woman who used to be a farm worker and who told her that in order to keep her job every season, since they hire seasonally, she had been forced and coerced into having sex with her supervisor in order to get her job and keep her job. And of course, that was jaw-dropping. And she came back to UC Berkeley and spoke with some of her professors and advisors. And you know, everybody was startled and jarred by this incident. And I think then the reporting question became, well, is this an isolated situation, or is this actually a widespread phenomena that for whatever reason we have just not been aware of? And so it took many years of kind of ramping up the reporting, but eventually in 2012, a bunch of us dug in, and lo and behold, everywhere we went, from Florida to Washington State to Iowa to California, these were essentially an open secret in the fields, that sexual violence, extreme sexual harassment was something that a lot of female farmers expected to encounter on the job.
So the women that you spoke to determine what had happened to them, how easy was you to get them to tell you their stories? And had they attempted to alert the higher-ups to get any action?
So it was, you know, all of the reasons that it made it very difficult to report this story were the same reasons that government officials and others were having a hard time pinpointing this problem. So there are so many structural issues that farm workers and low-wage immigrant workers in general have to deal with. Not only is there, of course, the language barrier, there's also the reality that some might be here with some pretty tenuous immigration status, and the supervisors, the coworkers who are doing the harassing, would often use immigration status as a leverage against them to keep them quiet and also to force them into unwanted sexual behavior. And then, of course, there's the fact that this is low-wage work. These are workers who are might be single mothers, might be supporting extended family back in the home country, and so they just... the math never worked out in terms of just being able to quit and to seek recourse. It was just they were afraid of losing their jobs. It was a very real concern for them because they just couldn't contemplate the idea of leaving their families kind of high and dry, you know, financially. Isolation was another very important factor in all of this. You know, these were farm workers or night shift janitors who were working in remote fields sometimes by themselves in empty office buildings at night. And so, you know, finding help and seeking help and finding a way in order to make a claim and a complaint was also a tremendous difficulty for them. And finally, you know, a lot of the workers we interacted with as newcomers were not always terribly familiar with this country's laws around sexual harassment and discrimination.
Right,
and
they might not have known that it was their right to have a violence-free workplace and that they could have spoken up, you know.
That's right. That's right. And so it took a lot of work by a lot of advocates and a lot of individuals who just kind of finally reached a breaking point for them to basically kind of toss aside all of those concerns and barriers and really come forward. But we did in the process meet a number of incredible and very brave, strong women who, despite all of these concerns, you know, put in their complaint and demanded that the government and their employers do something about this harassment.
And some of them have gone on to become politically active, which I'll ask you about a little bit later. But then your reporting, Rape in the Fields, was followed by a series called Rape on the Night Shift, and you mentioned janitorial workers. And of course, this also seems to be an area where women would feel that, or women would be very vulnerable. In fact, even the sort of the nature of the work can put a woman in danger, as you mentioned, working alone late at night in an office building. So tell me a little bit about that series and those stories.
So as we were working on the farm worker stories, one of our first interviews was with a government attorney who handles these types of cases for the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. They're kind of the federal commission that polices sexual harassment for the federal government. And he said, you know, I've been getting lots of, you know, information and lots of complaints from the farm worker community, you know, advocates telling me that this is a serious issue among those workers, but I would also suggest that you also look at janitorial work. You know, this is another area where we're seeing some cases. And so after we finished the farm worker series, we turned our attention to night shift janitorial. And, you know, it was, as he said, very similar dynamics. It was a similar demographic of worker, low wage, often immigrant women, and then very similar conditions. Isolated workplaces where, you know, if it wasn't a, you know, remote field like it was for the farm workers, it was an empty bank building that they were cleaning by themselves at night, where a supervisor might come and visit to check their work occasionally, and they would have keys to come into the building. And then the supervisor, unfortunately, would sometimes identify the places where there were no security cameras and use that as kind of the location for harassment and attacks. And, you know, we reported on a number of cases where that was the scenario. Bathrooms, supply closets, and so on became the locations of extreme sexual harassment.
Did it matter if the women janitors were directly hired by the company whose premises they were cleaning or working for a subcontractor?
Right. I think that was a very important element of understanding why sexual harassment was such an issue for so many janitors, night shift janitors, kind of how the industry is organized and what makes it harder in some instances to bring a case forward or to even know who to go to for help. So for the janitorial industry, actually very few large buildings and companies now hire their own janitorial staffers. It's not like in the past where you knew your local custodian. Now it's a contractor, sometimes a very large contractor, that will supply the janitors for an entire building, for an airport, for a county government building. And so there'll be a kind of a third-party employer. And then sometimes, because there's so much work that's happening, some of that contracting might be subcontracted and then further subcontracted. And then there's just layers of opacity to who is the actual employer. And so we encountered, you know, employees, janitors who, you know, got to a point where they wanted to make a complaint, and it was just, they got turned around in terms of whether they should go directly to the building where they've seen a very nice, you know, facilities manager that they felt comfortable talking with, or whether they should go to, you know, the company whose name is on their paycheck. Sometimes it was their supervisor, but maybe it was the supervisor who was harassing them. So it created a lot of just confusion and made it difficult for mm-hmm. women who wanted to make a complaint.
If these are immigrant women who may not be comfortable in English and or worried about legal status in the country, it adds extra layers. And of course, this is how a lot of corporations manage to avoid responsibility, because they can point to the subcontractor and say, well, it's not really our responsibility, it's subcontractor. The subcontractor can point back to the original corporation. Then there's also, of course, the issue of domestic workers in general. Women are, and of course, the vast majority of people who do the work, domestic work, whether it's as nannies or hotel workers or house cleaners. Again, here you have these sort of layers of invisibility and unaccountability. Can you share with us some of the stories of some of the women that you profile in your book who've been part of those industries?
Right. So, after looking at farm work and night shift janitorial work with the book, I extended and took a closer look at what was happening among domestic workers who, if you think about, behind closed doors, they literally are behind closed doors of private homes where it's very difficult to get any kind of scrutiny or enforcement, labor enforcement, if something should go awry. And I think there's something about domestic work that, it's work that is being done in someone else's home, and what their needs are and what they expect in terms of how their household is run, perhaps what kind of care they need if they should be elderly or if they have children that they're caring for. They need to provide care for. I mean, it's so particular. And so there's just a lot of room for perhaps unrealistic expectations in some senses for the workers themselves and what's expected of them. And, the domestic workers, I met a woman, for instance, named June Barrett. And she is from Florida, or she's from Jamaica originally, but now she lives and works in Florida. And, she spent her entire life as a domestic worker. She's originally from Jamaica. That's the only type of work that she's really known, except for short stints in office work. And in the United States, it's certainly the only work that she's done here. And for her, she's just had to endure a lot of uncomfortable and scary scenarios where employers have grabbed and groped at her, asked her to get into bed with her. Sometimes the groping is daily and constant. She's been also raped at work by an employer in her home country. These are, again, things that are happening where no one else is looking and where no one can see or hear her when she, needs help. And because domestic work is purposely excluded from many federal labor laws, it's not even always clear how someone like June would seek out protections around sexual harassment in the workplace. The federal protections for that, the federal law says that there's coverage for workers who work for a company of 15 employers or more. But if you're a single lone domestic worker in someone's house somewhere in a suburban cul-de-sac somewhere, what is the government entity that is going to protect you? And I think that remains an open question for a lot of domestic workers.
Now, because these are different fields and there's different industries, it seems as though it's not clear what's the sort of one single standard and one single recourse that these women often have. And you point out in your book that we have a system in our country today where we rely on reporting of a case as a way to address violence, rather than having preventative measures that are put in place right at the beginning. So instead of an upstream solution, we have a downstream solution, which often just doesn't work well enough. Can you address that?
Absolutely. I think that you hit on what I believe is a key point of this book, which is, yes, we need legal recourse, and we need the ability, we need workers to have the ability to seek justice through the legal system. It can be a deterrent for companies, for individuals. There is an important reason that, you know, that kind of recourse is in place. But of course, for June, for so many of the women that we have met in the fields and, you know, working in buildings at night, seeking legal recourse is way too late. You know, it's at a point where already terrible, terrible things have happened to them. They are now traumatized. I think the idea ideally would be to figure out how do we avoid this type of extreme harassment in the first place. And, you know, in terms of how would we solve this, you know, kind of enormous problem, I don't have a quick and easy answer. I think that what the book illustrates is that when workers and worker advocates get together and really push on this issue together and figure out industry-specific solutions or approaches, that it holds a lot of promise. I think it's difficult to just say all workers, you know, that we will be able to solve sexual harassment for all workers across the board through these three magic bullets. Mm-hmm. I think what the workers have shown us in janitorial, farm work, and elsewhere is that when the workers are informing the worker advocates and their employers about where the pain points are, where the vulnerabilities are, then you can start to really, you know, figure out workarounds to prevent extreme sexual harassment. I mean, just as a very simple example, night shift janitors have said, well, could we shift our hours to maybe early in the morning till mid-morning? Just so that some of that risk of working late at night is eliminated. Or could we work in pairs? You know, so it's two female cleaners in a building so that they could be supportive of each other if something should happen. For farm workers, you know, we were hearing lots of incidents of, you know, from across the country. So this seemed to be some kind of modus operandi where supervisors would ask their farm workers to get into their, you know, company-issued truck to move them to another part of the field or the orchard, and it was in that ride where they were isolated in that truck where some of the harassment assault would happen. So there are some farms that have a very clear policy where supervisors are not to drive their farm workers in their trucks alone. And so, you know, again, this is just responsive to the actual conditions of the job. And I think there's a lot of potential if we really, really wanted to look closely at the particulars to end run some of this harassment.
You mentioned earlier just now that these women have been traumatized, and this is an important aspect of it. You know, when we read the stories of Harvey Weinstein's abuses of Hollywood actresses, these women who finally felt safe enough to speak out wrote op-eds in newspapers, related the harrowing stories of what they went through and suffered in silence from, but we don't often enough hear what the low-wage workers that you profile go through, although, of course, your book tells us some of those stories. How important is it for us to recognize that that trauma is quite deep, quite real, and it can follow, it can scar a person for life, right? It can lead to all sorts of problems, addiction and unemployment and just a loss of self-esteem, etc.
You know, it's incalculable, really, you know, the way in which, you know, experience like that can just will haunt you. I think that what's been amazing on the flip side, and this is not to minimize at all, you know, what they have had to work through and continue to work through, but I have also been fortunate to speak with a number of workers who have experienced this, who believe that things can improve. And part of how they think that things can improve is if they put themselves out there and share their stories and make it real for all of us who might, you know, not otherwise have an opportunity to meet a farm worker or a night shift janitor,
right,
where they
it
work.
It can be cathartic to say out loud what has happened to you and to be part of your healing process. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think there's got to be the process to getting there. I can't fathom, and I have tremendous respect for everybody who is walking that very difficult road. But you know, one of the women who became literally the face of the Rape in the Fields project, you know, if you go and go to the Frontline website and you look up Rape in the Fields, you will see her image, and that is Marie Cruz Ladino. And it took us 7 months before we finally found somebody like her who was willing to go on camera for the documentary, you know, showing her face. And, you know, it was a very challenging process for her after, you know, we finished the project and her story was, you know, broadcast on national television, on the internet, on public radio. There was some, you know, really negative reaction from people in her community where they were calling her names and saying really cruel things. And so you can imagine that on top of the trauma of having had all of that happen, you know, and the fear and shame that comes from, you know, that a lot of people feel, I think, you know, and being concerned about reporting some of this because they're afraid of that shame and not being believed. And here it was happening to her after the fact, you know. But I spoke to her sometime after the project launched, and I asked her if she regretted, you know, sharing her story with us. And, you know, to that point about how it can be cathartic, she said, you know, no, I did it for a reason. I wanted other women to know, and I wanted them to know that it was okay to say something. And for me, she said, the rape had been like a cancer for her. And so talking about it was like taking her medicine. And I think for us, we were always looking for people like Marie Cruz, who, for whom speaking out had an altruistic purpose and also a meaningful purpose, personal meaning for them. So yes, it's you know, that we have met with too many people who become so upset by having to talk about this issue, but I think they are driven by a larger altruistic purpose in speaking out, and it's humbling and inspiring.
How much do you imagine things have gotten worse today under the Trump administration for particularly women who might be worried about their immigration status, right? Because not only are they worried about keeping themselves safe in the workplace, but now there's the added fear of, there was always a fear of deportation, even under Obama. Now the fear is even greater. Do you know, as far as you can tell, if through women you've been keeping in touch with since you did the work for your book, that things are worse now?
Well, what I can say is that I've spoken to ICE agents and to ICE itself, you know, the Immigration Customs and Enforcement, and they've told me that their practices have, or their priorities have not changed. You know, that they continue to focus on deporting criminals and so on. And, you know, that's for debate, that's for more reporting. But what I can tell you is that the anxiety that immigrants feel and immigrant communities feel is real. And I can tell you that some of the lawyers that we've spoken to that represent these women have told me that they cannot in this moment, in good conscience, recommend that their client go to the police or even file a case in some
wow.
instances.
So suddenly the reporting aspect has become even harder. All of the obstacles for vulnerable women to report crimes that might have happened to them, now there's an even sort of greater incentive to not report if they've been victims of a crime.
There's also a really interesting American University survey of law enforcement, judges, prosecutors, and social service providers looking at immigrant victims of crime that will be released soon. Hmm. I don't have all the details, but I have written about the findings related to law enforcement. And what law enforcement have noted from 2016 to 2017, you know, is a difference in their observations related to immigrant victims' willingness to come and report a crime. And a majority of those law enforcement officials who participated in this survey believe that it is now harder to do their job because of current immigration
wow.
Policies. So mm-hmm. I think, yeah, there's it's always been challenging. And the messages that immigrants and immigrant workers are receiving probably are not helping them feel more comfortable coming forward.
Bernice, tell us also about the women who, from their, you know, have actually been part of the political movement for change. Some of the women who, for example, you write about Vicky Marquez, a woman who is who's working to make it easier for women janitors to report the sexual abuses that they face. Tell us about the stories of these women who are doing quite heroic work.
Right. So Vicky Marquez, she works for the Maintenance Cooperation Trust Fund in Southern California. And they're this very original kind of organization that works with non-unionized janitors in California. There are a handful of other organizations like it across the country. But what MCTF does, what Vicky Marquez does routinely, is they go out and find workers, night shift janitors, where they are, and that's to say on the job. So they will regularly essentially do what they call undercover operations. They will show up at a building, say in Orange County, and they will walk in through the front door that is unlocked and look for the janitor, usually by the bathrooms, which usually need to be cleaned, and then maybe the supply closet. And when they encounter a janitor, they will introduce themselves and basically tell them, I wanted to make sure that you were aware of your rights, that you're getting paid regularly, that you're not having to buy your own cleaning materials, and also, you know, how are you feeling? Are you feeling safe on the job? And in that way, they've really been able to identify some of the hardest to pinpoint labor violations.
Wow. Walk right in and talk to these. That's bold.
That is bold. You know, and someone like Vicky Marquez, who used to be a night shift janitor herself, you know, is very relatable to the workers. So, you know, I've been told she's like an aunt, you know, she just understands and without very much explanation their reality. And so it's easy for her to kind of get the conversation going.
And finally, Bernice, how related to sexual violence is our sort of economic setup, our system today, that, you know, the vast majority of victims of sexual violence are women, the vast majority of perpetrators are men, and that mirrors the dynamic in the economy as a whole, where women tend to be the ones doing low-wage work, their supervisors tend to, you know, men tend to be supervisors, and that sets up a system that enables harassment and abuse, just as we saw in Hollywood, where a man like Harvey Weinstein was able to get away with everything he got away with for so long because he was so influential, able to make or break careers, that in a way, the very system of the workplace enables sexual violence. Is that part of the story?
I think so. You know, you hear from, when we ask night shift janitors, farm workers, what would make things better? They say, if there were more female supervisors. The idea being that if there were more female supervisors, maybe there would be less harassment, less, you know, likelihood that male supervisors would be exploiting their power through sexual harassment. I think it's an important point to make that it's not just, you know, men who do the harassing, and it's not just women who are on the receiving end of the harassment. It's across gender and sex and all of those things. But, you know, decades of social science research has shown us that when sexual harassment is clearly not tolerated by the leadership, and it's demonstrated that way through actions, and policies that are acted upon, there is less sexual harassment. And so I think there is something to be said about there were more female supervisors who could empathize with something like sexual harassment. You know, arguably they would take a leadership position where they would be less tolerant of sexual harassment, and there would be tremendous ripple effects.
Well, Bernice, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for the work that you've done with your book. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Bernice Yeung. She is an award-winning journalist for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She was a 2015-2016 Knight Wallace Fellow at the University of Michigan. We've been discussing her latest book, In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Good morning. It's 8:59, and this is KBOO Portland. Coming up in just about 2 minutes, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly news and commentary program, digging deep into the news you're not supposed to know. Air Cascadia at 10. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, two Northwest authors, Jenny Forrester and Lydia Yuknovich, talk about their recent work. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. Keep informed and get involved by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. It's 9 o'clock.
Happy birthday!
The Oregon Historical Society is featuring 50 years of KBOO. The exhibit was created to relay our history and demonstrate the importance of community radio, featuring archival photographs and ephemera collected from KBOO's 5 decades of broadcasting. The exhibit tells our story in our members' own collective words. Our online tour features highlights from the exhibit and companion audio clips to enrich visitors' experiences. The exhibit runs until July 29th at the Oregon Historical Society at 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information and audio clips can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly Media Manipulation.